Okay, now we're recording the show. I've been doing this for some 5-6 months now, and I'm finally getting used to doing everything in proper sequence, like recording my own show. This is Mideast Madness, coming to you every Monday at 4 p.m. Got a couple of crises to talk to you about. One of them, particularly given the name of the show, you already know about, the hundreds and hundreds of you out there who are listening to this show. The other one is one that perhaps you've been aware of. Maybe you're totally new to it. If you Santa Cruzians are just thumbing up and down the FM dial here, maybe this is the first you've heard of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Free Radio appears to be, this is not an official announcement, but we simply appear to be on the verge of having to shut down sometime next month, probably. We're currently paying a $500 a month rent, which we simply can no longer afford. Most of the monies that keep this radio service going and internet radio service going comes from the people who do the shows. I pay every month. Other programmers pay every month for the privilege, and as far as I'm concerned, the right to do this. The rest of it has to come from you. Being a free radio pirate underground service, not regulated by the FCC, because we believe strongly in our message and in our right to get it out, being that, as it were, we can't get grants. I mean, we cannot get these massive grants from foundations, philanthropists, or even not-for-profit groups. I mean, I suppose we could if we had more professional grant writers amongst our tiny numbers. But we really need your help, folks. If you want to see Free Radio Santa Cruz continue and continue to hear Mideast Madness among Church of the Subgenius and Captain Fred's World Cruise and all these other wonderful programs on Free Radio here, first of all, please send your donations. Folks, any amount will do. And you don't have to do it only once. But we do ask you, our listeners, to contribute as often as you can, as much as you can, or as little as you can. Dues from the programmers pays the rest. But we ask you to send your donations to FRSC, Post Office Box 7811, Santa Cruz, that's S-A-N-T-A, second word, C-R-U-Z, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. FRSC, Post Office Box 7811, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Please, folks, everyone these days, it seems, is asking for your donations, for your monetary help, whether it's some scruffy guy or gal on the streets of Santa Cruz here, or whether it's the State of Israel, which helps itself to dollops and dollops of American taxpayer money. Everyone's asking for money. So are we. No question about it. The other thing about this particular crisis number one, is we need a new studio. We can no longer afford our current location. We're looking at $300 or less a month, something near downtown Santa Cruz, 24-hour access, of course. We need a bathroom. Plus or minus 150 square feet. Utilities included would be nice, but we don't want to have to pay a parking tax. I'm not sure what all that's about. And it needs to be reasonably secure and dry, etc. Perhaps what motivates the request for a dry location is we're in a basement right now, and there is the ever-looming possibility of some moisture leaking in and corroding our equipment. So, again, we need a new studio near downtown, 24-hour access with a bathroom, roughly 150 square feet, no more than $300 a month if we want to continue and with this service. Utilities included, no parking tax, secure, dry. Thank you for listening to that. Now, getting back to Mideast madness. The other crisis, of course, is what's going on in the Gaza Strip in historical Palestine. Very quick history here, of course. Gaza was, after the creation of Israel in 1948, Gaza was occupied by Egypt. At least it was kept out of the hands of Israel until 1967, when Israel took it from Arab control. That was in 67. Finally, in 2006, in an apparent bid to lessen the pressure on Israel to let go of their West Bank settlements, Ariel Sharon, prime minister at the time of Israel, decided to let Gaza go, at least in terms of closing the illegal Israeli settlements in the Gaza Strip. They were put there to begin with to intimidate the Arabs and to just lay counterclaim against the Arab for the land. So in 2005 or 2006, that occurred. Then there were elections observed by international observers, including Jimmy Carter, in Gaza and in the West Bank. The Fatah party, Yasser Arafat's original party, political party, retained control of the West Bank, but the Gaza Strip came under the political control of Hamas. Hamas did legitimately win the election in the eyes of the world, in the eyes of the observers, election observers. There was a very, very brief civil war as such when certain members of Fatah refused to relinquish power and Hamas exercised some violent tactics to expel them. At any rate, that doesn't change the fact that Hamas was put into power legally through choice by elections. Hamas is still in power, and ever since then, the Palestinian version of Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood, that's what Hamas is, they have Israel has responded, the Israeli government has responded to this scenario, feeling very threatened as they are by any Islamist political party or activity or militant group. Israel has made life very, very difficult for the Palestinians who live in the Gaza Strip. It's true that the Jewish settlements are gone, and for the most part, the so-called Israeli Defense Forces, I would rather refer to them as the IOF, Israeli Occupation Forces, the bulk of them have left the Gaza Strip, but they are and have been constantly going in, crossing the border, running patrols, and shooting at Palestinian civilians and children, and occasionally killing them. Anytime you hear a supporter of Israel claim that Israel uses the greatest restraint and only at the very last moment will use their military might, to suppress unrest or naughtiness or whatever. That's bull. It's just BS. I've been to the Gaza Strip, and a number of my cohorts on that trip remained behind when I left, and they reported faithfully how the Israeli troops would do this. They would fire across the border. They would send their tanks in at the slightest provocation. Of course, these provocation is usually the firing of mortars and then eventually rockets, and just make life very difficult for the farmers and others who are trying to eke out a living. Now, I promised it would be a very short version of history. I guess I'm getting a little carried away, but the bottom line here is, as far as United Nations international law is concerned, the occupation of Gaza, of the Gaza Strip, remains in effect because sealing off borders, which is what the army does, the Israeli army is doing, and the Egyptian army on the south, because they don't care for, at least until their latest elections in Egypt, they didn't care for Hamas, so they were in cahoots with Israel. Both of those nations have sealed off Gaza's borders, not letting people in or out with rare exceptions, not letting imports or experts traverse the boundaries, which really keeps the Gazan economy as a basket case. To spare parts and replacement parts for utilities such as water plants, clean water plants, electricity, facilities at hospitals, medical supplies are often impossible or nearly impossible to get. They need far more. They needed them far more before this latest battle, quote-unquote, that Israel has befallen upon the Gazans. And, you know, Israel, with a very slight exception 4 years ago, a few times, now Israel is not letting any travel, any seaborne travel in or out of the port of Gaza City or any place else in Gaza. You know, the West Bank is landlocked. Gaza is the only Palestinian-owned territory which does have access to the sea. Basically, one port area, and that's the port of Gaza City. The Israeli Navy will not let people go in and out. They can always use the excuse that Iran or Syria or someone is trying to pipe missiles and parts of weaponry by sea, and perhaps that has happened. I'm not saying that's out of the question. I'm saying that the real reason for Israel's restraints, strangling restraints, an economic siege on Gaza really goes back to Hamas's coming into power and taking the worst, the bad end of the spectrum viewpoint of a free election. The Israelis are trying to get the Gazan Palestinians there to put Hamas out. This is Israel's idea of pressuring the population to use their newly won democratic freedoms to elect Hamas out. That is the real purpose of Israel's restraints on Gaza. According to everything I read, that's what it amounts to, and that's my understanding, having visited there 4 years ago. Let me get this boycott stuff out of the way here. Boycott SodaStream. What is SodaStream? It is an appliance, a kitchen appliance that makes fizzy, sparkling drinks in your own home. SodaStream which is known by at least a dozen other names, is also made in illegal Israeli settlements in the West Bank of Palestine. We are, the Palestine-Israel Action Committee of Santa Cruz's Resource Center for Nonviolence is concentrating on this one particular product because there are several outlets in Santa Cruz County. And we just want to bring people's attention to the situation. We don't want them to buy it, and we are trying to educate them that products made in the Israeli West Bank settlements use illegally seized Palestinian land, water, and minerals. Exploitation of natural resources in occupied territories is not allowed by international law. Of course, that's a drop in the bucket, considering the many, many countless and longstanding ways that Israeli Jews have been taking from the West Bank, land that they acquired by military force in a surprise attack in 1967. SodaStream is made in the West Bank Mishor Edomim Industrial Park in the Ma'ale Adumim settlement, an industrial park in an illegal Israeli Jewish settlement on Palestinian land. Incidentally, the Palestinians don't receive any profits from products made in occupied territories using Palestinian resources. They have no agreement whatsoever, not so much as an agreement with the settlers, with the industrial park facility there, for any kind of royalties, use of land. Palestinians are simply ignored by the settlers, not to mention being attacked physically as well as in their press, in a variety of ways. Life is hell for the Palestinians in their own land, where they languish without sovereignty, without political or civil rights. The product is called SodaStream here in California. In the name of human rights, boycott SodaStream. For more information, email PIAC, that's the Palestine-Israel Action Committee, at calcentral.com. Let's go over the immediate situation in the Gaza Strip. First, I'm going to read you a timeline, which was put together by the International Middle East, the IMEU. I can't remember what the U stands for right now, but it's International Middle East Union or something. Information house, many information houses, where you can get reliable information about what's going on. Timeline, Israel's latest escalation in Gaza. Now, please pay close attention because the mainstream American media, various media outlets are going to tell you that this is simply a matter. Even our precious Barack Obama is going to tell you that Israel has a right to defend itself. And at least on camera, he says nothing about what's motivating the Gazans to send missiles into close to Tel Aviv and in the area around the western Negev desert. Okay, Israel's latest escalation in Gaza, November 14. That's last Wednesday, as of last Wednesday. On Wednesday, November 14th, it was reported that Israel assassinated the leader of Hamas military wing, Ahmed Jabari, breaking a tentative truce with Palestinian fighters that had been in place since Monday. The truce followed an escalation in violence that began last Thursday, the previous Thursday, in which six Palestinian civilians were killed, including three children, and more than 50 others injured. This is the beginning of the timeline, folks. This is all before the major aerial bombardments began. 6 civilians killed, including 3 children, and more than 50 others injured. The IMEU, the information house here, offers the following timeline of the recent violence and a link to an IMEU fact sheet on previous Israeli ceasefire violations. Timeline, Thursday, November 8th. Okay, here's the real timeline now. November 8th, following a two-week lull in violence, Israeli soldiers invade Gaza. In the resulting exchange of gunfire with Palestinian fighters, a 12-year-old boy is killed by an Israeli bullet while he plays soccer. Shortly afterwards, Palestinian fighters blow up a tunnel along the Gaza-Israel frontier, injuring one Israeli soldier. At that point, no Palestinians have killed an Israeli. Saturday, November 10, an anti-tank missile fired by Palestinian fighters wounds four Israeli soldiers, just still killing no one, driving in a Jeep along the Israel-Gaza boundary. And they were, in fact, soldiers, not civilians. An Israeli artillery shell lands in a soccer field in Gaza, killing 2 children aged 16 and 17. Later, an Israeli tank fires a shell at a tent where mourners are gathered for a funeral, killing 2 more civilians and wounding more than 24 others. By the way, if any of you out there want to refute any of this or question any of this, I'll give you the phone number shortly. So have your pen and paper handy or your little smartphone so you can record permanently, semi-permanently, our station numbers for as long as we continue to have them anyway. Where mourners are gathered for a funeral, killing 2 more civilians and wounding more than 24 others. Sunday, November 11. One Palestinian civilian is killed and dozens more wounded in Israeli attacks. 4 Israeli civilians are also injured as a result of projectiles launched from Gaza, according to the Israeli government. And all, you know, after all the killing and taking of lives of innocents by the Israelis, all we ever seem to hear on the nightly news, on broadcast television and CNN and Fox, etc., is that those nasty Gazans, that evil Hamas, wounded 4 Israeli civilians in rocket attacks. That's what we're hearing from the evening news. 4 Israeli civilians injured as a result of projectiles launched from Gaza, according to the Israeli government, as though this launching of rockets is just a fun little mischievous thing that the Gazans like to do once in a while, or more often than once in a while, as though they have no other very serious motivations for doing this. During an Israeli government cabinet meeting, Transportation Minister Yisrael Katz urges the government to, quote, cut off the head of the snake and take out the leadership of Hamas in Gaza, end quote. He also calls for a cutting off of water, food, electricity, and fuel shipments to Gaza's 1.7 million people. Well, they've actually been doing that to a high degree already, highly restricting access to water, food, electricity, and fuel shipments. So we're really just talking par for the course here in terms of what the people, in terms of how the people are being treated. Monday, November 12, Palestinian militant factions agree to a truce if Israel ends its attacks. That was last Monday, November 12, a week ago today. Palestinian militant factions agree to a truce if Israel ends its attacks. Wednesday, November 14, 2 days later, Israel breaks 2 days of calm by assassinating Ahmed Jabari, the head of Hamas military wing. According to reports, at least eight other Palestinians are killed. Eight other Palestinians are killed in Israeli attacks, including at least two children. Palestinian militant groups vow to respond. So the timeline I've been reading to you is already a week old. The last event was November 14th of last Monday. Or I'm sorry, Wednesday, November 14th. Okay, so we're shedding some light on the IOF's actions, on the Israeli military's actions, which, by the way, as far as I can tell, are often quite independent from the directives of the Israeli government. But that by no means makes the Israeli government saints, and certainly doesn't make the Likud, the very conservative Likud party, saints. Okay, here are the phone numbers. Directly to the studio, to me, you'll be live on the air, unless you request not to be. No, take that back. I'll take that. You will be live on the air. You have to take your chance if you're going to call me. Area code 831-427-3772. That's 427-3772. And the second line to our studio, same area code 831 here in Santa Cruz County, California, USA. 469-3119. Again, 469-3119. Please call me. Have the guts to call me. Also from the IMEU, International Middle East Information House. Now this, speaking of Israel's breaking the rules and fending off public attention from that fact. Also from the IMEU, here is an article entitled Self-Defense or Provocation? Israel's History of Breaking Ceasefires from March 15th of this year. And this is Mideast Madness, brought to you on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, streaming live at freakradio.org. Santa Cruz County, California, March 15. Since Israel's creation in 1948, Israeli political and military leaders have demonstrated a pattern of repeatedly violating ceasefires with their enemies in order to gain military advantage, for territorial aggrandizement, or to provoke their opponents into carrying out acts of violence that Israel can then exploit politically and or use to justify military operations already planned. Continues, the following fact sheet provides a brief overview of some of the most high-profile and consequential ceasefire violations committed by the Israeli military over the past six decades. Listen up, folks. Pay close attention. 2012, this year, on November 14, 2 days after Palestinian factions in Gaza agree to a truce following several days of violence, Israel assassinates the leader of Hamas military wing, Ahmad Jabari, threatening to escalate the violence once again after a week in which at least six Palestinian civilians are killed and dozens more wounded in Israeli attacks. Okay. Also this year, back on March 9, Israel violates an Egyptian-brokered ceasefire and assassinates the head of the Gaza-based Popular Resistance Committees, sparking another round of violence in which at least two dozen Palestinians are killed, including at least four civilians and scores more wounded. As usual, Israel claims it is acting in self-defense against an imminent attack being planned by the PRC, that's Popular Resistance Committees, while providing no evidence to substantiate that allegation. Following the assassination, Israeli journalist Zvi Barel writes in the Haaretz newspaper, and I quote, "It is hard to understand what basis there is for the assertion that Israel is not striving to escalate the situation. One could assume that an armed response by the Popular Resistance Committees or Islamic Jihad to Israel's targeted assassination was taken into account. But did anyone weigh the possibility that the violent reaction could lead to a greater number of Israeli casualties than any terrorist attack that Suher al-Qaeser, the Secretary General of the Popular Resistance Committees, could have carried out?" Quotation continues from Haaretz. "In the absence of a clear answer to that question, one may assume that those who decided to assassinate al-Qaeser once again relied on the, quote, measured response strategy in which an Israeli strike draws a reaction which draws an Israeli counter-reaction," end quote. Again, that's from Israeli journalist Zvi Barel. Just after 2 months prior, on the third anniversary of Operation Cast Lead, Israeli Army Chief of Staff Lieutenant General Benny Gantz tells Israel's Army Radio that Israel will need to attack Gaza again soon to restore its power of, quote, deterrence, and that the assault must be swift and painful, quote unquote, concluding, quote, "We will act when the conditions are right." That's an Israeli Army general, a chief of staff, Lieutenant General Benny Gantz, over Israel's Army Radio. "Needs to attack Gaza again soon to restore its power of deterrence." What does that mean in terms of missiles? They certainly did not stop the missiles 4 years ago, around just after Christmas Day, 2008, and going into 2009 with their attack. They did not eliminate the presence of missiles even then, and there are even more of them now. Some deterrence, huh? 2011, on October 29, Israel breaks a truce that has maintained calm for 2 months, killing 5 Islamic Jihad members in Gaza, including a senior commander. The following day, Egypt brokers another truce that Israel proceeds to immediately violate, killing another 4 Islamic Jihad members. In the violence, a total of 9 Palestinians and 1 Israeli are killed. 2008, in November, Israel violates a ceasefire with Hamas and other Gaza-based militant groups that has been in place since June, launching an operation that kills 6 Hamas members. Militant groups respond by launching rockets into southern Israel, which Israel shortly thereafter uses to justify Operation Cast Lead, its devastating military assault on Gaza beginning on December 27. This is back in 2008, folks. Over the next 3 weeks, the Israeli military kills approximately 1,400 Palestinians, most of them civilians, including more than 300 children. This is also Israel can restore its power of deterrence, right? A United Nations Human Rights Council fact-finding mission led by South African jurist Richard Goldstone subsequently concludes that both Israel and Hamas had committed war crimes and crimes against humanity during the fighting, a judgment shared by human rights organizations such as Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. Let me break in here before I read the rest of the article and point out, some of you may remember that the Goldstone Report UN Human Rights Council fact-finding mission led by South African jurist Richard Goldstone, that his report, that committee's report, was starting to receive a lot of attention as a concise and complete report of what happened. And the Israeli lobby in Washington, D.C. succeeded in in preventing Congress from even reading it. I mean, I suppose as individual Congress people and senators could have read it on their own, but they, Israeli lobby, hefted its weight and intimidated our Congress, the American Congress, the U.S. Congress, to not including a taking of the contents of the Goldstone report as an official matter. Back to the article. 2002. On July 23rd, hours before a widely reported ceasefire declared by Hamas and other Palestinian groups is scheduled to come into effect, Israel bombs an apartment building in the middle of the night. In the middle of the night, an apartment building in the densely populated Gaza Strip in order to assassinate Hamas leader Saleh Shehada. 14 civilians, including 9 children, are also killed in the attack, and 50 others are wounded, leading to a scuttling of the ceasefire and a continuation of violence. 2002, on January 14, Israel assassinates Raed Karmi, a militant leader in the Fatah Party, following a ceasefire agreed to by all Palestinian militant groups the previous month, leading to its cancellation. Later in January, the first suicide bombing by the Fatah-linked Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade takes place. You know, one of my pet peeves is the virtual abandonment of the use of hyphens. No one uses hyphens. I mean, there are so many problems with the English language, going between verbs and nouns and verbs and adjectives. People don't want to use hyphens anymore. Please, folks, use hyphens to make yourself understood. I also want to point out that in this article, there are several, blue-inked, underlined links. I mean, there are clauses in some of these sentences that are underlined, because when you look at them in the internet, you can click on them and get more detailed information and the sources for these stories. If you're at all dubious about what I'm reading you, go to IMEU's website. Google IMEU, plus human rights or Palestine, whatever, and you'll be able to take advantage of those links and see for yourself. 2001. On November 23rd, Israel assassinates senior Hamas militant Mahmoud Abu Hanoud. At the time, Hamas was adhering to an agreement made with PLO head Yasser Arafat not to attack targets inside of Israel. This is back in 2001, folks, several years before Hamas did take political control of the Gaza Strip. Following the killing, respected Israeli military correspondent of the right-leaning Yediot Aronat newspaper, Alex Fishman, writes in a front-page story, and I quote, "We again find ourselves preparing with dread for a new mass terrorist attack within the Green Line." That's Israel's pre-1967 border. "Whoever gave a green light to this act of liquidation knew full well that he is thereby shattering in one blow the gentleman's agreement between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority. Under that agreement, Hamas was to avoid in the near future suicide bombings inside the Green Line." Dot, 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 end quote. A week later, Hamas responds with bombings in Jerusalem and Haifa. In other words, this question Fishman puts to the world through his article, whoever gave green light to this act of liquidation, Israel, Jerusalem, the government of Israel gave it. Questioning his own country's misdeeds. 2001, on July 25, an Israeli and Palestinian authority, as Israeli and Palestinian authority security officials meet to shore up a six-week-old ceasefire, Israel assassinates a senior Hamas member in Nablus. Nablus is in the north of, is not too far from Jerusalem in the West Bank. 9 days later, Hamas responds with a suicide bombing in a Jerusalem pizzeria. Well, folks, according to these sources, it turns out that Palestinian terror, Palestinian suicide bombings are not willy-nilly. They're not coming out of nowhere. They're in response to something which, par for the course, is not being thoroughly examined by the American mainstream news services. 1988, going way back to 88 now, in April, Israel assassinates senior PLO leader Khalil al-Wazir in Tunisia, even as the Reagan administration is trying to organize an international conference to broker peace between Israelis and Palestinians. The U.S. State Department condemns the murder as an, quote, act of political assassination. In ensuing protests in the occupied territories, a further seven Palestinians are gunned down by Israeli forces. Protests in the occupied territories. It is by no means unusual, I might add, for Palestinians to die by the gun. Guns of the Israeli occupation forces during protests happens all the time. Not just talking rubber bullets here. Lives are taken. Many, many people injured. Back to the article. 1982. Following Israel's invasion of Lebanon in June and after PLO fighters depart Beirut under the terms of a U.S.-brokered ceasefire, Israel violates the terms of the agreement and moves its armed forces into the western part of the city of Beirut, where the Palestinian refugee camps of Sabra and Shatila are located. Shortly thereafter, Israeli soldiers surround the camps and send in their local Christian Falangist allies. Even though the long and bloody history between Palestinians and Falangists in Lebanon is well known to the Israelis, and despite the fact that the Falangist leader, Bashir Gemayel, has just been assassinated and Palestinians are rumored, incorrectly, as it turns out, to be responsible. Over the next 3 days, between 800 and 3,500 Palestinian refugees, mostly women and children, left behind by the PLO fighters, are butchered by the Falangists as Israeli soldiers look on. In the wake of the massacre, an Israeli Commission of Inquiry, the Kanaan Commission, deems that Israeli Defense Minister and future Prime Minister Ariel Sharon bears personal responsibility, quote-unquote, for the slaughter. And this, of course, was the incident where, even though Israeli soldiers might not have been doing the shooting in this particular instance, they laid a red carpet down for the Falangists, Christian enemies of the PLO, to come in and exercise their slaughter. And the Israelis provided light for the Falangists to see what they were doing during the massacre by firing flares into the sky. The Israeli soldiers fired flares into the sky to assist the Falangists to kill hundreds and thousands of Arab refugees. 1981 to 1982, under Defense Minister Ariel Sharon, Israel repeatedly violates a nine-month-old UN-brokered ceasefire with the PLO in Lebanon in an effort to provoke a response that will justify a large-scale invasion of the country. That Sharon has been long planning. When PLO restraint fails to provide Sharon with an adequate pretext, he uses the attempted assassination of Israel's ambassador to England, attempted assassination, to justify a massive invasion aimed at destroying the PLO, despite the fact that Israeli intelligence officials, the PLO has nothing to do with the assassination attempt. In the ensuing invasion, more than 17,000 Lebanese citizens are killed. 1973, following a ceasefire agreement arranged by the U.S. and the Soviet Union to end the Yom Kippur War, Israel violates the agreement with a, quote, green light from U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. According to declassified U.S. documents, Kissinger tells the Israelis they can take a, quote, slightly longer time to adhere to the truce. As a result, Israel launches an attack and surrounds the Egyptian Third Army, causing a major diplomatic crisis between the U.S. and Soviets that pushes the two superpowers to the brink of nuclear war, with the Soviets threatening to intervene to save their Egyptian allies, and the U.S. and the United States issuing a DEFCON 3 nuclear alert. DEFCON 3 is very serious. That's one level short of all-out nuclear war. And I shall point out, this is by no means the only time in Israel's 64-odd-year history that Israel has done, something related to the Middle East conflict there, has led to severe DEFCON alerts and a ratcheting up of the nuclear element between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Israel. 1967. Israel violates the 1949 armistice agreement, launching a surprise attack against Egypt and Syria. Despite claims Israel is acting in self-defense against an impending attack from Egypt, Israeli leaders are well aware that Egypt poses no serious threat. Yitzhak Rabin, chief of the general staff of the Israeli army during the war, says in a 1968 interview that, quote, I do not believe that Nasser wanted war. The two divisions he sent into Sinai on May 14 would not have been enough to unleash an offensive against Israel. He knew it, and we knew it, end quote. Quotation from Yitzhak Rabin, chief of the general staff of the Israeli army. And former Prime Minister Menachem Begin later admits that, quote, Egyptian army concentrations in the Sinai approaches did not prove that Nasser was really about to attack us. We must be honest with ourselves, says Begin. We decided to attack him. Prime Minister Menachem Begin. Whoop-de-doo. How about that? 1956. Colluding with Britain and France, Israel violates the 1949 armistice agreement by invading Egypt and occupying the Sinai Peninsula. Israel only agrees to withdraw following pressure from United States President Dwight Eisenhower. Finally, 1949. In our timeline of Israel's history of breaking ceasefires, 1949, immediately after the UN-brokered armistice agreement between Israel and its neighbors goes into effect, the armed forces of the newly created Israeli state begin violating the truce with encroachments into designated demilitarized zones and military attacks that claim numerous civilian casualties. Phones are not ringing. There are only 5 minutes in my show left, folks. Area code 831-427-3772 or 469-3119. By the way, this show is being recorded after I get it all set up here. After the broadcast, you'll be able to go eventually to radioforall.net and receive it and record it and do whatever you will with it. I'm working on archiving all the shows which I have succeeded in recording at radioforall.net. That's RADIO, the number 4, ALL.NET. All right. I prepare so much stuff for the show and I run short of time. Of course, I did have those emergency messages about Freak Radio Santa Cruz about to go under, apparently. That's a very real possibility within a few weeks. No longer being able to broadcast, I wanted to get that information out to you. And then I went into my not-so-short history of the Hamas and the Gaza Strip, folks. Free Radio Santa Cruz needs a new studio near downtown. Maximum of $300 a month if we are to continue this service. Underground radio, pirate radio, freeing the airwaves since 1995. If you are even remotely aware of anyone who has such a facility, give or take 150 square feet with a bathroom and 24-hour access, please call this number or go to Freak Radio's website and contact us through the website. I gave you the phone numbers here. Please send your donations. If you're very rich and suddenly the angels are descending upon you and making you realize that this is your key to heaven, you may send a huge dollop to FRSC Post Office Box 7811, Santa Cruz, California 95061. FRSC Post Office Box 7811, Santa Cruz, California 95061. Don't forget to boycott SodaStream and to educate yourselves about how Jewish settlers in illegal settlements in Palestinian territory are exploiting the Palestinians' resources to make a profit. There are, at least officially for the next 6 minutes, and I apologize for not mentioning this earlier, there is an action, an event taking place at the downtown Santa Cruz clock tower, taking advantage of the home rush hour people to let them know that there must be a ceasefire between Gaza and the Israelis. And that's really just another form of education. This is Lawrence Tuiel Wren, or Larry, if you will. This is Mideast Madness. I'll see you next Monday at 4 p.m. Thank you so much. Don't forget to donate. Boycott SodaStream. Long live Palestine.